Okay.
My name is Suhak Shukla. I serve as the Managing Director and Legal Counsel of the Hindu American Foundation. I'm also one of its co-founders. The organization provides a progressive voice for the Hindu American community, which is about 2 million across the nation. Last night, it was really refreshing to see religion as such a central topic in the Democratic, coming out of the Democratic Party, because it's something I haven't seen after being politically aware. So I thought that was really refreshing, and just the message of inclusiveness. They seem to be committed to it, mm-hmm. and they're following through on it as well. So,
Okay.
I'm Megan Paul Cook. I work for the St. Paul Area Council of Churches. I coordinate an interfaith youth leadership program. So I work with teenagers to engage them in interfaith dialogue and service learning and leadership development activities. And I am, my life is kind of in this area of the juxtaposition of faith and civic life. And so I'm really fascinated by how the conversation around religion is really, the whole framework for the conversation around religion is really changing in this era, even coming from the White House. And so that's kind of where I was coming from with last night's discussion.
I'm Richard Scheel. I'm a sophomore at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, American Studies major. Last night I was very interested by just how he addressed some of the issues. One in particular that interested me was when he talked about President Obama's commitment to responsible fatherhood and healthy families.
Okay. My name is Kashyap Saroya, graduate of Wisconsin-Madison. Not a party pooper with any Tims. I've been involved in the community on many different areas. I work, I was a founding board member for a civil rights organization. It's the only civil rights organization here for Muslims in Minnesota, CARE Minnesota. I also am a speaker, part of a speaker's bureau called Islamic Resource Group. We give presentations to public schools, churches, law enforcement, and all other places. I also work with the youth. And I know I worked with Megan as well on some of the things with interfaith.
My name is Jonathan Gross, and I'm a resident of Edina and a member of the Adath Asheron congregation, which is about to celebrate its 125th anniversary next month. Mm-hmm. I've been a longtime supporter of MPR, and I'm an advisor on a fund of the Jewish Community Foundation, which helps to underwrite speaking of faith. And if these little dots represent the listening audience, I'm this little blue outlier way out here because it doesn't sound like I'm nearly as active as most of the people here.
Hello, all. My name is Muna Noor. I also went to Carleton, graduated in 2008 with a degree in international relations. And since I was there, I guess I was attracted to life of service beyond what I'd experienced before I came to this country from Kenya. And with that experience, it just opened a lot of doors to, I guess, many of the communities here to give service, to receive service as well, to be nourished by that interplay between work and family and faith and religion and all of that. And I guess what attracted me last night was trying to find the resources so that the people who are not aware of those resources can tap into that and I guess create an engaged but also responsible community for all of us. So I'm the typical idealist, I guess.
I'm Pat Gordon-Rice. I'm the program manager for Hazelden Foundation's drug addiction program, outpatient program in St. Paul. I'm a recovering addict. I've been in recovery for 24 years. I guess I am probably the person who represents no religion, but I believe in a strong spiritual faith of my own background and combination. I think last night what was interesting for me is that there's more dialogue of other sides to the debate of Christian versus non-Christian and opening it up to a wider audience. And understanding. And I loved that he talked about commonalities of where we are similar, because that's where I do in much of my work around spiritual issues is helping people understand where do they come from spiritually.
I'm just curious, would you be one of those unaffiliated? Would you answer the question as unaffiliated, please?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So,
yeah, I'm one of those people.
Point,
that I would,
but you're
I
very
would,
spiritual.
I liked what you said about that doesn't mean we're against religion, because I don't think I am at all. I don't belong to any.
Well, it's pretty striking when you look at that poll. It's like it's 15 or 17% unaffiliated, but it's 1.5 or 2% that identifies as atheist within that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's just very interesting to me that there's that much scope in it. So,
I'll go to any church.
Open-minded. Yeah.
I find the recovery community does spirituality a whole lot better than a lot of other organized religion.
Yeah.
I'm Shane Isaac. I'm a pastor in Plymouth of a small church, Plymouth Creek Christian Church. They asked me to come serve as their minister in August, so I'm still pretty new to Minnesota. Came from Lexington, Kentucky, 2 years. Go Big Blue. last night, I was really interested by the common ground conversation too, talking point, common ground, common purposes, and I thought that was really interesting. And I spent the night thinking about not only the value of that in terms of getting people to move together towards particular policy possibilities, but also the limitations of it, and how me as a pastor and as a person of faith. Both has unique wisdom and gifts to share with the families and people of my community, and the ways that I can share those while still being open to the unique gifts and wisdom of people who have a different religious commitment than mine, different religious tradition, no particular affiliation, but still unique wisdom and gifts that I could receive. So.
And I'm Meg Mannix. I'm the National Program Director for the Ignatian Volunteer Corps, which is a national program in 16 metropolitan areas. We engage retired men and women, 50 and better, in service to the materially poor. We partner with agencies that already exist. And we have a guided reflection process for our volunteers to help them find meaning in their service. I was particularly drawn last night to the whole conversation about people are hungry for meaning and people are hungry for community. And I think with our organization, we blend those in service. I think there's so many volunteer opportunities, but there aren't a lot of volunteer opportunities that provide the structure to support and help a person. We like to quote T.S. Eliot, I had the experience but missed the meaning, because we provide the experience and we help people find that meaning. So I am just so excited that this is now a central part of policy discussion in Washington, and am just anxious to see where all this goes. We have so much to do in this country, and there's so many good-hearted people who want to help, and they just don't know what to do, so...
I'm Aaron Lauer. I am a master's student at United Theological Seminary. I was actually raised a fundamentalist evangelical and have done a complete 180, and I'm now a Unitarian Universalist humanist. I'm very interested in, as everyone else has kind of already expressed, religion in public life, civil religion. I think that's a big interest of mine. Also very interested in religion on a sociological level and how people engage in worship and ritual and myth and rite, and how that kind of inspires them to go out into the world and do these acts of great, you know, generosity and kindness and seeking the liberation of oppressed people. So I think that what Mr. Dubois had to say last night really tapped into that. So.
Hi, my name is Elise Weinberg. I work at General Mills. And what interested me last night was the opportunity to hear Joshua Dubois, who's in Obama's administration. I was interested in seeing what he had to say, and also, like some of you have said, the juxtaposition of integrating your faith and action, your faith in public life, your faith in civic life. I find myself very drawn to social causes, and specifically social causes abroad. I'm sure we're all aware of just, you know, human trafficking, stuff like that. So I find myself increasingly drawn to the plight of social justice issues abroad. And I wanted to know what Joshua Dubois had to say and what the administration can do to potentially influence for good other countries so that perhaps more light could be shed on some of these tragedies abroad. So I guess I was thinking kind of globally, and what can this person do in Barack's administration to further advance awareness and knowledge of what's going on outside our borders. And I myself personally just follow Jesus. I don't like labels, and I don't like religion, and I don't like organized anything, but I just had a personal experience with Jesus in college. It changed my life, and so that's all. I just follow Jesus. Sorry.
There's something that we don't that's talk a lot about in
I
our
said
culture.
The J word. Now it's out there.
I was just going to say that religions, that the great religious traditions are the original globalized institutions, right? And there is potentially a real power in that, and I don't even think we've begun to realize it. Of course, there's power for ill as well, but...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My name is Doug Donnelly. I'm serving as pastor of University Baptist Church in Dinkytown. We've got this wonderful sign out front of our church that says, "A Liberal Baptist Church," which kind of makes people kind of go, huh? but Baptists traditionally really believe in freedom, and that everyone has the right and responsibility to make up their own decisions about what Scripture means and about how to govern oneself and how to live as a faithful person within community. And so we try to live that out at the congregation. We're a lot of university people, and so there's tremendous pluralism even within the congregation. And I coordinate on campus the Interfaith Campus Coalition, and we're very, very interested there about moving beyond the polarization in religious talk and finding the commonality. And that really impressed me last night about the conversation with Josh Dubois, is that he was really speaking in language of pluralism, mm-hmm. and speaking in language of commonality. And when talking about religion, he wasn't talking about the polarization piece. Mm-hmm. He was talking about the nuanced piece. Mm-hmm. We keep that sign, liberal Baptist, kind of go, wait, there's got to be a nuance to it. And so let's figure out a way to make that work. I also serve on the board of the Baptist Peace Fellowship in North America, which is a four-nation organization in North America that from a Baptist perspective, promotes peace and justice around the world. And locally, I serve on the board of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. And I was very excited to hear him speak last night also about the need to reduce unintended pregnancies and to have compassion upon and with people who are in those kind of experiences. And I think there's tremendous ways that we can move forward together if we move away from the polarization.
Hmm. It was quite a struggle getting a program called Speaking of Faith started in public radio. I actually mm-hmm. pitched the idea in the late 90s when religion in politics and public life was very polarized. I think there were really to a degree that's hard to imagine now. There were just a few very strident voices, Christian voices, who'd come to stand for what religious people sound like. And they didn't even represent all Christians. They didn't even represent all evangelical Christians. And I saw this black hole where I thought an intelligent discussion of religion should be that drew out the spiritual and intellectual content, which was almost always missing even when religion entered the news, and also a discussion that would somehow get at this diversity and breadth with which this part of life is lived. It wasn't reflected in our political debates, but with which it is lived and which is represented around this circle. I'm kind of telling you that to say, I can't tell you how exciting it is for me that here we are, actually 10 years later after the original idea for the show, and about 6 years after since the show's been a national weekly program, that
that Minnesota Public Radio can be a place that hosts this gathering. It's just thrilling to me. And I actually had the seed for the program was in some work I did with the Ecumenical Institute, with the Benedictines up at Collegeville. Benedictines are kind of original ecumenists. They like to feel like they predate all the divisions of Christianity, not just Protestant, Catholic, but East-West. And they've done some wonderful, innovative ecumenical work across the years globally. And that's where I got the idea for this way of conversation where you could start, where people could talk, as everybody has around this circle, not only in terms of what they do and what they believe, but who they are. And it's really kind of immediately powerful and disarming. And I think that's also what Joshua Dubois was getting at, what he experienced in those settings that he talked about going around the country. When you get people to tell their stories as well as talk about what they care about, you can connect as human beings, and you can still have different stories, and you can still be on different places on issues, but you can be together as human beings. And I really do. I wouldn't be doing this program if I thought it was just about having new conversations. I mean, I really believe very much that the more we can learn to talk about what we care about out of our deepest places together, then we can live differently, we can walk forward together, even if we continue to disagree. And we will continue to be different. There's no question about that. It was really important to me, I think, kind of getting at something you said in my ecumenical work, to see that what happens in ecumenism, and also I've seen this in interfaith work, is not that people lose their identities. I think exactly the opposite happens in really exciting, vital interfaith and ecumenical encounter. People become more richly planted in the ground in which they are planted, but they also, you know, their eyes are open to the humanity of other traditions, and also finding very practical ways that they can work together and I think be of service to the world. And I just want to say one other thing, just in terms of the notes I was making as you were all talking. I had a really interesting conversation recently, not on air, off air, with Varun Soni. Do you know him? He's the religious dean of religious life at USC, and he's the first Hindu to be a dean of religious life at a major American university. He's not the Hindu chaplain. He's the dean of religious life for the whole university. And he was talking about the commonality of religious traditions, that he, I think, as a Hindu, you know, he feels that it's in his spiritual sensibility also to be very tuned to that anyway. But he said something that I thought was so dramatic and interesting and new, and I heard it echoed around this table. He said, you know, and you know, a lot of people will start a sentence this way. You know, all of these religions, in the end, they come down to a few, they have a few essential things in common. But the word he used, I think 10 years ago, if you were having that conversation in this country about what religions have in common, it might be kind of superficial. It might be about, or very personal. It might be about self-enlightenment or understanding yourself to be something larger than yourself. But what he said is they all boil down to service. And I actually think that represents a generational shift in seeing the common essence of these great traditions and of the spiritual search, even when it's not inside one of these great traditions, as boiling down to service. And, you know, this is what came out in the conversation with Joshua last night. And, you know, this is in the work a lot of you do. The Interfaith Youth Corps of Eva Patel, which is a great interfaith youth project, is all about service. And you move from service to theological conversation. You move from service to bringing your strong identity into the mix, and understanding your strong identity as making a real contribution. So, you know, from where I sit, I think we're in very exciting times. And I have incredible confidence in how the new generations are going to infuse this and carry it forward. So that's what I'm thinking as you're all talking. And, you know, let's talk about also anything that wasn't addressed last night, or anything that you felt like we just touched on and you'd like to take it a little farther. I mean,
What comes to mind?
I was just wanting to add to what you just said. When people describe spiritual experiences, they talk about being beyond religion. And for me, I've not had that spiritual experience as of yet, but when I serve, when it's that hands-on, roll up your sleeves, let's help someone, all those walls of identification drop. And so again, you're pulling away from religion. So it's kind of interesting how, to me, it's kind of juxtaposed in that sense that if all religious traditions or spiritual traditions do boil down to service, it is at the top end and at the bottom end, or however you lay the spectrum, a dropping of walls. Mm. And for centuries, we've lived with all of these walls, and I think finally we're talking about them. And so I liked that. I'd never thought of it that way, but in looking at it, and when, at least for me personally, whether it's the advocacy work that I do at the Hindu American Foundation or whether I'm volunteering with refugee resettlement, those are the things that are appealing because I'm able to see firsthand that this is a fellow human being mm-hmm. who's facing so many issues that I have or my parents did. So,
I really think it's a joining of the divine, and we all find the divine in a different way. There's a wonderful Indian Jesuit called Paul Coutinho, who's written a book called How Big Is Your God? And he was raised in a Hindu, in Bombay. He was raised in a Hindu community, but was raised by Catholic parents and educated by Jesuit priests. And so he became a Jesuit priest, but he has this wonderful sort of a much more global understanding. And he talks about the divinity is in each one of us. And when we serve, we are touching that divinity in each one. And I think that's what connects us, is what draws us to other people. It draws us into community. And it's what enlivens us and enriches us is that connection, I think, among the divinity. And it doesn't matter how you define it, how you find it. I think that it's there's, but it's that Frankl's search for meaning. I mean, it's when you are in service to another person, when you are other-centered, you become more authentically human and in touch with your divine, I think. And that's what we're about. That's why we've been created.
I think it's interesting, too, that when I first started in going to AA, the 12-step was about having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. They changed it to having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I really have seen that as being you do certain things, you experience certain things, and therefore out of that experience you awaken spiritually, and that it's an ongoing awakening. An experience really feels like, well, I went out and and I fed the poor one time. Well, that's an experience, but it's not it can be part of an awakening. But it's also about service to others and going out and slowly awakening. And for me, I always come from a drug addiction background because that's kind of my work and my life. But it's also about it's helping people understand that it's sort of drug addiction isn't something that you just you quit drugs and you're fine. It's an awakening to life, and it's ongoing, and it's not about having a year, 24 years. It's about for the rest of your life, you are awakening spiritually, developing who you are going to become, and overcoming your past, but really moving into the future and being part of the divine or whatever people call it. And you said the J word. Well, often we laugh about the G word because people are offended by the G word, God. Yeah, and so higher power for some people is offensive. And also everybody finding their own spiritual awakening in whatever faith background they came from, or developing a new faith background or faith, or just being where you are currently and being okay with that. So I liked the piece that you said about the experience and the doing and the service, and therefore that becomes your spiritual being, or that becomes who you are spiritually.
You know, maybe that's an interesting way to talk about how this conversation has shifted, because when I said 10 years ago when people talked about the commonality, I think it might have been more in terms of awakening, which is really important. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is more a stress on the experiential now and the awakening flowing out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
And that may be better for our common life. I mean, I'm sure there's not one right way to do it.
And then an awakening doesn't just, I mean, you don't just wake up in the morning. You slowly wake up. I mean, maybe the alarm clock goes off, but it takes me 10 minutes to, you know, kind of come out of the fog, you know. Yeah. So, and a spiritual awakening takes time. You know, it's not something that you just happen to have. You know, it's ongoing. Even if you have an experience, most of us, I think, then grow from that experience on another level.
Just to add on to it, it also helps if the environment is there. If someone is respecting you for who you are, or respecting you to, show what your abilities and what you believe in, that mutual respect that has been talked about, I think that's very important. I mean, as a community or as a Muslim, we've experienced that in the last 8 years or so, where it was very, it's very interesting now that whenever a debate, speech happens, President Obama uses Muslim. It's not about any other term. We're not hearing those, you say G word or J word. For us, it was there are many other, for us, there's isms and all those things that are connected and are being associated or were associated with the religion. Now that room is being given where, when I work with the youth, I see them kind of reflecting in who they are, in identifying who they are. And I think when they identify and they come forward, they bring with them their experiences, their stories. Mm-hmm. And I think just from the Muslim community, there are 5 to 7 million stories that are there to be shared, and I'm sure with other faith groups as well. And I think that's very important to listen to each other and have that kind of atmosphere where we can respect each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not just respect each other, but being willing to be changed, mm-hmm, by someone else's story. Mm-hmm. I know that's one of the things that frustrates me as I look back at this sort of polarization idea of that religion can be so polarizing. It's when, in my interpretation, when a number of religious folk, Christian religious folk like me, would walk out into the public arena and say, here's what I believe, here's what I have, you need it, but I don't need anything from you. Mm-hmm. When we get together and serve, I feel uncomfortable boiling us down to this common idea. Practicing is a good idea, practicing stuff together, and then on the back end, saying, all right, you know, change me. I'm willing to not only listen, but to take in. And I think that would be the religious value of humility would be really fantastic, or just the value of humility would be nice.
You know, we use service so much as a noun in religious life, that we go to a worship service. You know, that this is the service, and this is how we define our religious practices, by going to a service. And I always end the worship services that I have at the benediction, which is the closing words that the pastor says, is now the service begins. Nice. And changes it from a noun to a verb. And let people dance around that with their imaginations and see how they can move it from a noun to a verb.
In Latin, Catholics call it a mass, that's our service. And in Latin, that's missa, which means sent. So that at the end of, you have celebrated together, you worship together, now you are sent out, and you do. And I think that's missing sometimes in people's experience of their ritual, but that's That's what it's meant to do.
I think touching upon what you said about humility, coming from a religious tradition that's relatively new to the American landscape, you know, the past 30, 40 years, it's been interesting as a second generation Hindu American to kind of see the emergence of a distinctly American Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And what I'm experiencing and what I'm witnessing is taking the positives from the entire community, whether it's other faith communities or just American culture, and incorporating it and making it part of a living tradition. In India, temples serve the ritual needs and the religious needs of Hindus. But in the United States, you're beginning to see temples that are also trying to reach out to the spiritual needs, whether they have lectures from spiritual leaders who will come. That's not something you see in India. You're seeing Hindu Sunday schools, so it's almost kind of a oxymoron. but I mean, my children go to a Hindu Sunday
school. Muslim Sunday schools too, aren't
right?
It's always surprising to me.
And so it is interesting because even though we're now beginning to just talk about it, it already has been ongoing in subtler ways. But it's nice to acknowledge it and to kind of look at it and even compare to how, say, Christianity or Judaism is in Europe or in other parts of the world. From the Hindu perspective, we get to see how Hinduism develops not only in the Hindu American diaspora, but in other regions of the world.
Hmm. I have to say that
yes.
With regard to Mr. Dubois, that I remain skeptical in the most positive sense of that. That is questioning. It's not cynical. It's only because when the words faith, religion, and belief are used in the same title with a government office, it makes me a little bit nervous. And I don't want to seem overly hypervigilant, but I mean, even just this morning, there was an announcement about how a terrorist plot was foiled,
in a synagogue, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So for me, I like to think of my background more as a tradition, in the sense that when Mr. Dubois was talking about shared common values, I see that as putting those values into action. So. All the things that were said last night, most of them sound very good. I'm a little concerned about the mission to aid the flow of federal funds to religious societies. I'm glad that neighborhood organizations are included in the title. so when you start, it seems to me that you need to start with the service and identify the needs and the service, and then if that corresponds to a particular community group, religious or not, then that makes sense to me. But to start from the other side and say, we're going to target specific
faith-based
mm-hmm. groups, there's the potential there for bias. Hmm.
Even use of the term faith as the sort of defining characteristic
yes.
has a very particular religious tradition that it comes out of, and that's targeted. That can seem sort of biased too, I feel. So,
right. I mean, as far as the office is concerned, they actually don't make the grants. They're sort of a grant referral service, and that would be a useful. That would be useful for various nonprofit organizations and communities.
I think that was an important piece of information.
Yes.
I'm not
yes.
sure that I really clearly understood that until I started preparing for the interview.
I had written down a question. It wasn't one that was asked, but what I wanted to know is, okay, that's fine, but then in the tradition of MBAs, then how do you measure the results? is
what they're saying. I mean, clearly, it's in a way, it's unfair to interview him at this point because it's so new. As you said, they don't even have their stationery. But what they're saying, how they say they will measure the results, is not in terms of how many organizations got how much money, but the theme, the issue areas that they've identified, which included abortion reduction, but also strong families. What were the others?
Interfaith dialogue.
Interfaith dialogue globally. There's one I'm forgetting. Oh, anti-poverty, I think.
Economic recovery.
They want to try to set some benchmarks to say, has progress been made in these areas? And I think, have these kinds of organizations participated in that progress? But that's going to be a tricky thing to do.
Yes.
Also, those organizations would participate in that progress, whether there was a White House office or not. Right? I mean, that's what everybody around this circle knows.
Right.
I want to say that, see, I actually feel like, also from a little bit of the way he talked to me before we went in to the interview, you know, I think they are working very hard to counteract precisely that skepticism, to be very inclusive, to not talk too much about faith. And I actually think that's going to be their challenge. Obviously, I also care so much about the commonalities, and what's so fascinating about this kind of extended conversation I have in the show is the echoes that come through, right? I really love our differences as well. I love, even just in this little brief conversation we've had, the different vocabularies that we bring. I mean, bringing the Latin word in, just talking about the nuances even of the word service and what it means in different traditions. The whole is much richer because of... So unity, even if we want to talk about unity, doesn't mean uniformity. It means that we bring our gifts, and that they have their own integrity in the mix. They don't get blended in necessarily. And I think a way to talk about that in very orthodox terms is to honor the mystery of religious life and religious experience and religious traditions. You know, I think that a reason very orthodox and even conservative, all these words are problematic, but I think the reason that everybody can, in fact, be part of this discussion is because even in the depths of these great traditions, there is this command to honor mystery, to stand before mystery, to honor the fact that there are things we will never understand in this lifetime, and I think that the existence of religious otherness is mysterious. We can be absolutely true to the depths of our traditions and orthodoxy and embrace the other. And that's very exciting. I mean, I kind of think that's where we are in the 21st century. So just back to you, Jonathan. I mean, I think their challenge is going to be communicating that inclusivity and also finding a way to honor religious vocabulary and really strong religious identities. I think that's actually what they're not sure how to do right now. I mean, aside from the fact that Barack Obama himself is very comfortable talking about his personal faith, and, you know, that's kind of where they are, that the president can do that. But I think Joshua has got kind of a learning curve.
Well, I mean, I think that religious communities also find themselves in... I share your skepticism, but I share it, or I have it from the side of the religious communities, and that I think that religious communities will be walking a very fine line if they do engage in kind of this government-funded action that Mr. Dubois' office directs them to. And that is that if religious communities are supposed to be about service, many times this service is going to be a type of prophetic voice that is actually counter to government action or the politics of today. I think that that's really what religion is in so many traditions, is a voice that stands up against the status quo and the way that things are and challenges us as communities and as individuals to engage ourselves in, you know, liberation of people who, you know, have been marginalized and have been cast aside. And so I'm very interested to see how different religious communities engage if they are funded, because, you know, will they feel afraid to present that prophetic voice in our society if they are, in fact, so... if they're funded by our society, they're funded by public dollars. I think that Mr. Dubois' answers last night were great, but he was very political, and you could see that he was definitely had a certain agenda that he was presenting, and there's nothing wrong with that. He works for the White House. You know, that's his job. But I would be worried that other religious organizations who then become funded through the government would also, you know, start to turn their speech toward a more being more sympathetic to the operations of our government, when instead they should be standing up against them.
And we forget that the founding fathers, many of them, the way we tend to talk about separation of church and state nowadays is we don't want religion to sully government. But for many of them, the point was government sullies religion. Yes, exactly. That religion is tainted when it becomes too enmeshed with government, and that's kind of
that's just part of the tension. I mean, you talk about honoring the mystery, but I also think the other piece of our existence is we just live in tension, because there's what's pure and true and divine, and then there's what's of the world, and to live in the tension of bringing those sides together for the good of each other. But I think that service can be delivered without proselytizing. I think service can be delivered, good can be done, outreach can be made without, we're not missionaries necessarily trying to change people to our way, but we're trying to help situations, and I think that can be separated.
May I comment?
Yeah.
I hope that my faith is service, and who I am are inseparable. I hope someday that I don't go and do something. I hope that I am,
right. And
that I minister to people just because, excuse me, who I am and the love that I have for other people. So I think there's a delineation between what we think and how we need to define things, and what we actually can do. And I think labels, I'm just not a fan of labels, so I just think they're hard to deal with. But they're easy. We like them because they're easy, and we all go, oh, okay, we get it. But I hope that service in my life is something that I do when I wake up during the day, in the evening, when I see someone, you know, on the side of the road, or, excuse me, frog in my throat, just in interacting with people on a daily basis, I hope that I show them the love that's been given to me. And so I hope that there's not, I don't know. And I'm having a hard time finding my voice here, but I really wanted to comment something on what you said, and that something my pastor said once was that he's not a real big fan of government being involved in your faith at all. And, I mean, just for government to not... What you're saying, I guess, is what I'm trying to comment on, and not very articulately, but I forgot what I was going to say. I guess, okay, move on. I totally am like... I guess what I'm just trying to say is, I had it. In the best of all possible worlds, perhaps we wouldn't have government. All of our faith communities would reach out and take care of people in the best of all possible worlds. All of our individual faith communities would come around people and take care of them. And I think that's the way it's supposed to be, actually, in the New Testament. We're not really supposed to be relying on government. We're supposed to just have our faith communities do what they say they are going to do and do what they are. But the need is so great, and the problems are so big, that I struggle with the tension of how much does government have to be involved, and is that just a crutch, and, you know, shouldn't we be the ones going out there and feeding this, you know, feeding the needy and taking care of the sick? I mean, shouldn't we be kind of leading that forefront? And so I guess I'm just saying, I'm understanding what you're saying in the tension that I actually didn't think about until you said that just now, but it reminds me of what my pastor said. I go to Woodland Hills Church, just what he said, just that, you know, maybe we can, you know, he's not a real big fan of government, you know, being involved and stuff like that. Not for the same reasons, but for the reasons that were the church or in the mosque or the synagogue. Well, I can't speak for other faiths, but in the church, we're supposed to be the ones taking care of those people.
Well, actually, I think I can kind of tie things together. Your comment about the Latin derivation from the mass and your motivation. In Hebrew, the word for prayer and work are the same, avodah. And it's not because prayer is so much work, at least that's what I'm told. It's because putting your values into action is a form of prayer, of making tangible what you believe.
I think that's what she was saying too. It's mystical, because when you can transform yourself and not say, I'm going to go do this, but I'm going to try and be the best person I am. I'm going to be who I am, and flawed as that is every day, but I'm going to try, you know, to reach out. And I think that's kind of mystical, personally.
Yeah. I wanted to comment on yours, too, Jonathan. I worry about how government and faith communities are going to be working together, because I am not part of a faith community and don't see myself as part of a faith community. So it feels like, well, will I be the one who's now marginalized? You know, so we're going to include the Muslim community, we're going to include the Hindu community, we're going to include the Jewish community, but or the Unitarians. but, you know, what about people like me? You know, like, where do I fit in? And if we're saying there's 50% of us are not, you know.
15.
Okay. Oh, dang, is that all?
Sorry.
I was hoping for more. But, you know, that really is disappointing. But, you know, where do we fit in? And how do I get my voice then? So we've, you know, another place that I come from, besides being a drug addict, is I'm also a lesbian. So I also feel often marginalized by the faith communities in that way, too. And so how does that part of me get recognized? Can we have a special office for gender identity? You know, I mean, where does this stop? I'm really skeptical also and despite I work for an organization that is, in many people see, as being a faith organization, because we're a nonprofit that, you know, works with the 12 steps, which many people think is Christian. I personally don't think it is, although it may have come out of those roots. So people wouldn't want us to necessarily get money for that, and yet I'd be up there going, like, well, we're just like spiritual people, you know? I don't know. I thought he did a very broad, wonderful political sweep, but I also felt a little left out, because it was, you know, our Muslim friends and our Hindu friends and our Christian friends and our, you know, Jewish friends, and I'm thinking, I wanted to wave both my hands. In fact, that was the part I didn't do, because it felt too. I don't know, when he told me to raise both my hands, it felt too evangelical or something. I want to be included in that too, so it feels like.
I think two words though that strike out from yesterday's conversation, which, having been interacting with the previous faith-based office and this one through the work that I do professionally, was constitutionality. And I don't remember that word coming up previously, that are we going to be concerned with the constitutionality of faith-based funding? And I think that this office seems to be committed to that was one of their four pillars among the many sub-pillars. And constitutionality to me is also akin to accountability, and that's another word that is becoming very widely used in so many different arenas in our political landscape today, whether it's foreign aid, whether it's bank bailouts, and hopefully it will still ring true for faith-based funding as well, that separation, the wall between church and state, I don't think needs to be so black and white all the time. And I can even say that comfortably coming from a minority faith community, where there are the dangers if that wall is not there, say in public schools or whatnot. But at the same time, if faith communities are already called to serve, or even those who are called from a firm belief in ethical values or just a firm belief in humanity, if they're called to service and funding in these types of economic times are tight, they shouldn't be discriminated against either because they're motivated by faith either. And so that's that balance that we have to strike in so many different arenas.
I don't get the feeling that the funding's either or. It's not all going to go to faith-based. It's going to be there's a place at the table for some funding if these categories of constitutionality and are met, but it's allowing them to have a piece of it. So it won't be, you'll be excluded, but...
And yet there's a special office now for...
Yeah.
Right. So there is a piece of that that goes against my own kind of grain of, well, you know, if what you're doing and the research shows that it works, then you should be able to compete as well as, you know, Medtronic and, you know, or, you know, a science kind of approach, that it should be based on outcome, you know. So if the outcome is good, you know, then it should, that's what it should be based on. And I understand that that's maybe what the government is going for in the larger piece of who gets the grants, but shouldn't there be, the office should be for anyone, you know, who wants the grant.
I think you're supposed to find yourself addressed in the neighborhood partnership part.
Maybe.
But you're right.
I mean, there's like
it is vague, and it doesn't, and the fact that you don't feel addressed is interesting, is worth noting.
It's interesting that we're talking about this tension between the relationship between government and faith communities and funding thrown into the mix. My program, actually, for the last 3 years has gotten federal funding. And there's incredible scrutiny and accountability and transparency that we have to account for in our programming. And one of the reasons why I think it works is... because our focus is on service and on bringing young people of different traditions together, not just engaging one faith community, but engaging young people of all traditions, including no tradition, to engage in service together. So we've kind of been wrestling with that tension for the last 3 years, and it's been really fascinating.
But I hear you saying it hasn't. It's been challenging, but maybe good and creative.
Yeah, and I don't feel like we haven't felt like there's been a barrier to still being a prophetic voice.
That's good.
You know, I wish we had. If we do this, if you don't want to have everybody's first name written really large, so I can see it. Sorry.
What I was going to say was that what's coming to the forefront right now, I think with this common ground that we're all finding, and that is so much in our purview right now, is the intentionality of it. And it's moving away from, I think, what happened with the world wars, which, you know, created the institutions that we rely on so much right now, and this functioning state that we, you know, that has taken care of much of our needs. But I think the communal ground, it's kind of, I think, right now, dissolved into the communal ground where every person is taking the intention of engaging the neighborhood, engaging sort of what sustains them, what they need, and, you know, who is the person next to me, what are they doing, how do they feel, do they feel safe, and do I feel safe in their presence as well. And what's happening with that is that this generation now is taking the initiative to make it, I think, much more the vocal point of, our togetherness. And every time that we get together, it's not just, you know, the talking points that are in our heads, but the person next to us. Mm-hmm. So that dynamic is changing where, you know, before we were coming out of the generation before, your generation was coming out of, you know, the Berlin Wall and the Prague, the Spring Revolution. You know, your generation now, before that, the baby boomers, much of that is taking us into a place where peace is not just an idea, but sort of a legacy. And we want to leave that behind. And this generation wants to adopt that for themselves, but also for the future. And I think with the platform that America has created for all of us is that discussion can happen. And it doesn't have to be driven by a system. But once the office is there and you can tap into those resources, it signifies sort of not the contention between the state and the church or the mosque or the synagogue, but the fact that we can all work together to create that common ground and work for it and be accountable for it.
That's what it signals to you. That's how you experience the existence of the office.
Right. I mean, it's so new. Uh-huh. He's so young. It's very unfair of us, I think, to put so much pressure on that on those shoulders. But the idea itself, what it signifies is that peace is not perishable. We cannot just leave it behind. The state cannot leave it behind. The community cannot leave it behind. Religion cannot take it away, even if people who represent a religion, an extreme side of that religion, want to take it away.
Even though I introduced the word skeptical, I that's not mutually exclusive with hopeful. And if the kind of funding is going on already, I'd much rather it be transparent than not. So that's a good thing.
I'm extremely encouraged by the status and the stance that the Joshua Dubois and the Obama administration has taken towards this. When I look back at faith-based initiatives in previous administrations, it seemed to be a way to slough off the accountability for them to do justice, and for religious people to take care of the charity. You know, that it moved from justice to charity. So we're going to make sure that all the poor are taken care of by religious groups so that the government doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. And so I'm finding a wonderful hopefulness as well in this stance of pluralism, of accountability, of constitutionality, to find out how we can both give service to people and do it in a just way and in a respectful way and in a way that recognizes everybody that's at the table and everybody that's part of our community.
Bringing the legality of it too into it, not ignoring that, but making that the foreground, that it's both legal but also, you know, something that is of service.
You both bring up something that I thought was that's helpful for me in sort of helping to find this conversation. We talked about service. But one of the things I think I've learned from my short experience is that different religious people—I mean, I was about to say traditions—but different religious people draw on their religious background and define what service is in a particular way. And one of the ways that I've learned about serving is by seeing what my neighbor sees and go, "Oh, wow, that's a place I could serve too." And you both bring up a way to talk about particular kinds of service that are really valuable. You talked about serving in a way that leads towards justice, or you talked about service in the service of peace, and I think different religious traditions are going to have different priorities or different congregations or people. But I think it's important that we're just open about our service is in service of.
Just to kind of elaborate a little bit on that as well, as I said, you know, I work with the youth as well. You look at your communities, you look at your neighborhoods, you see what is the need at that time. I mean, right now you see, because of the economy, because of the other aspects happening, we have a lot of homelessness. We have a lot of people who have lost their houses. It doesn't have to be, I need to get funding because I need to get special treatment because I'm Muslim or, you know, coming from an Islamic community. No, it's about what is the need in the community at that time. Our youth go to Salvation Army. We go there, we serve food. It's not about, of course, that might be driven by the faith. It might be driven with the values or the teachings. But when you're there and you look to the lines coming in and the individual, and you're having the conversation, it's no more that barrier, I mean, which faith group you're coming from. It's about, I am being part of change. I'm being part of contributing in my community. And that's the teaching, I mean, we want our youth to take. That's the teaching we all want from this initiative as well. And also to have that discourse where these things are talked about. I mean, I want, if one thing they can do is to have that, and I know he doesn't, which is very true, not to talk a lot, but to have action. And I think that's way true. I mean, we are at a point, we want to see the action happen. But they, at the same time, having that respect so everyone can get together. Like right now, we are having this conversation. It's amazing. Wow. Like I mean, I personally might not have even met you before. But just to have that dialogue, just to have the conversation and learning from each other, it might be two or three of us can, you know, take a step forward and, you know, lead from here and working together. So I think this type of conversation is very important, and then relate that into action. Mm-hmm. Because then we will respect each other. We will be educated about each other. Right. And I think that will be very important.
Educated about who each other are and how you live, as opposed mm-hmm. to... I can't believe it. I just looked up to say, well, you know, let's think about what comes next, and I realize we're out of time. Yeah. I want to say, and it follows nicely on that, as a journalist, something I've been very aware of ever since I started doing this work is I think that in American culture we have very narrow way of talking about people of faith and traditions of faith and faith in public life. And I think it must come from our Protestant Puritan past somehow. We've tended to talk about when you want to learn about a religious tradition, then you'll see lists of what they believe, right? And really it's only Christians who talk in that confessional way. And in fact, even with Christians, that doesn't get you very far. I mean, you can come up with lists of beliefs, but I actually felt very strongly that this was a hindrance in American culture's encounter with Islam after September 11th, when people needed to understand. And Islam doesn't work that way, just like Judaism doesn't work that way. It's a way of being in the world. It's daily lived piety. It's when you pray. It's how you pray. It's what you do rather than what you believe. And I think that that's true for all of us, really, at a deep level. What's exciting for me is, you know, that's the conversation we've had here, who we are, how we live, and why that matters, and how there's incredible particularity and distinction and diverse gifts that we bring in terms of how we talk about that, how we understand the nature of God and what that has to do with how we live. The virtues that our particular traditions bring, the different emphases they have, and yet we can meet each other in very practical ways that are of service to peace and to the common good.
The last program that you re-aired, Wally Nasser, the professor at Fletcher,
yes.
The point that he made about what is the sickness of secularism.
Yes.
Religion is not what is wrong. Faith is not what's wrong. It's that takes understanding. That takes the idea of just flourishing and, you know, bringing a community together, bringing that voice out, and having just, you know, very nuanced, very respectful conversation about it, and understanding, sort of taking it bit by bit and, you know, putting the puzzles together. Secularism is where it goes a bit off. Where you have faith, where you have religious communities coming together to bring out the secularism of those groups and take it into, say, international business, for example.
Right, right.
And make that an idea that it functions within itself, of itself, outside of that dynamic. That is the difficulty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And something that Mr. Dubois said a couple times at least last night that I found very interesting is we shouldn't have to check our beliefs at the door. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're asking people of faith to come into a community to work on problems and say you have to check your beliefs at the door, then what are we left with? We come in, we can't talk about our beliefs, then what do we have to stand on? Like, so that's very interesting that Elise was talking about being service and not just doing service. And because what she said about being driven by faith, I found very interesting that, like, for instance, I can say, like, if someone wants to start a program to help children in some way, we can say, with this faith-based organization, I can say that I want to do something to help children because Jesus loved children. He said to that we are children, because he loved me when I was childish, and I'm still childish, and he still loves me. And you know, I can say the J word and say, this is why I do it. And I think that's something that's very important, that we don't have to check our beliefs at the door, that we don't have to try and find another reason other than what we believe for what we do. And you also said what you do rather than what you believe. And I don't think that's necessarily exclusive. James said, show me your action. Show me your faith by your actions. I think beliefs and actions absolutely go together. I think there is a disconnect often between what we say we believe and what we actually do believe.
Or how we actually live.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the disconnect that is a problem.
Yeah. And what I find really refreshing about this forum, too, is that you can come out and say, you know, I'm a Christian or I'm a Muslim, or I can come out and say I'm a lesbian, drug addict, you know, pagan, you know, and not feel like I'm going to be shunned because of those labels, and that there has to be acceptance on all of those, all of those ways that we can have a dialogue about that.
And I go back to that. I mean, if we're all connected through some kind of divinity or however you want to call it, when any one of us hurts, mm-hmm. we all hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a scriptural image of the body, and you wouldn't cut off your hand. I mean, you can't function without all the parts of the body. They're all necessary. They're all different, but they're all necessary. And so, and one part is no better than the other. And so I look at that in a very holistic way, not just the body of Christ, as it's said in Scripture, to imply Christians, but it's all of us. And every one of those parts is important. And we all have different purpose. We all have a different gift. But to function the best way in this world means we all function together. And that's what I hope for.
If I may share a story
quickly.
And when the teachers taught this story, they said it shouldn't be, there's a weak chain to it. So there's a wisdom for weak chain, so don't use it for any legal perspective. But anyway, it's around Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him. He used to bring someone to his house for dinner. He didn't eat alone. So one night he brought in a person, and he was starting, and he started in the name of God. And the person said, well, I don't believe in God and stuff. So the Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, said, well, then you don't have place on my table, so you can leave. And in the story it said that at the same time, God addressed Abraham, peace be upon him, and said, who do you think fed him for 40 years? And you couldn't stand him for one dinner. And of course, he went back. And I mean, but there's, a wisdom in the story, no matter if it might be weak. And I think that's the relationship, and that's the concept we need to understand, that we all are in humanity. I mean, we have to work together to make our communities better. And I think that's the message we take back. And that's a very important message to take back. We shouldn't let people abuse or use religion for violence. We shouldn't let them use for, I mean, we heard about how in Pentagon, I mean, Bible verses were used addressing issues. I mean, these are the things which are abuses of a religion that might happen, and we need to address them as a community, no matter what religions or no religions or whatever faith, whatever we believe in. I think we have to work together to make our communities safe, because that's where we want our next generation to flourish in. And I think that will be a very important, I mean, at least for me, to take back from last night and from today.
I think that's a great last word. I would love to... maybe we can pull together everybody's names and email addresses, and you can tell us if you want your email address to be included, so that maybe we can stay in touch with you and you can be in touch with each other, if that makes sense, at some point. We could have kept talking for days, but I just want to say I'm really honored and thrilled to have all of you here. And I also love that imagery of the body, but it still helps to be able to look the other parts of the body in the eyes and have faces and voices. And
Yeah, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I think there's a little bit more food, so if you have to run, grab some. And maybe, I hope maybe we'll have ways to see you again.
Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.